This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Welcome back to another episode. The first African-American to command a ship, to take command of a fleet, and to become a flag officer was Samuel Gravely. And we're going to be talking about him today in coordination with the Naval History and Heritage Command's anchor dates. And we're going to focus today on his first command, his first ship. To do that, we're going to speak with one of his shipmates, Command Master Chief Richard B. Curtis, who served the United States Navy from 1961 to 1991 as an electronics technician, retiring in 1991 as Force Command Chief of SPAWAR. Chief, welcome to Preble Hall.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Why did you join the Navy?
Why did I join the Navy? It was a strong suggestion that I join the Navy. And I did when I went in. I'm not going to go into the details, but it was strongly suggested I should join the Navy.
You're not going to go into this story. This is one of the best stories you've ever told.
I had a job working at Schramsberg Winery up in between St. Helena and Calistoga, California. And they called me up there to work at a party just around Christmas time. So I was doing this and parking cars and doing all kinds of things. And a classmate of mine came to me. I didn't know she was at the party because I was busy. And she said she had a problem. The party was over. We were all 18 years old, graduates of Napa High School, Napa Union High. And her date, who was there, was a classmate of ours, was passed out. So she asked if I could give them a drive back from St. Helena back to Napa. I said, no problem. We piled into my old 1949 Dodge and we ran down the hill and started off, and I was pulled over by the ABC, the alcohol beverage control people. They had been monitoring this Christmas party. Anyway, we all had to get out, and what happened was she'd been drinking. They got her for that. The guy in the back seat was passed out. Obviously, he'd been drinking, and I had not been. But unfortunately, being the owner of the car, I didn't realize it, in this big bag, she had half of a bottle of champagne, some of Schramsberg's finest. So they nailed me for an open container in my car, and they got her for drinking and him for drinking, all of us underage. But I went in front of Judge Loughranini, when we all did, it was suggested that if we were in the military and out of town by the end of the week, we wouldn't have any records. And I was the first up. I went out the door, and the Navy recruiter was there, a signalman first class named Marvin Westcott, who recruited me. The Marine, the Army, and the Air Force guy were all at lunch. I took the test and I joined the Navy. I was a high school seaman recruit, no guarantees. I did well on the test, I guess, because I ended up going to boot camp and going through classification. They sent me to ETA school, Treasure Island. The young lady, she went in the Army, and the young guy who was passed out in the back seat, he went in the Navy. And I think he went in, came out of boot camp, got made seaman, was on the cruiser Helena, which I think was home ported in Long Beach then. And I think he got out of the Navy as a seaman. I don't know, but I continued on. I went to A school, and they sent me to a DER out of Pearl Harbor. But that's how I got in the Navy. So it was, you know, the phrase, I think they used to call it alternative sentencing. Which was a recruiting boom for the Navy and Army and the Marine Corps.
Now, one more question before we talk about your first ship. True or false, did you ever play with the Grateful Dead?
I never played with the Grateful Dead. However, I was, this is years after, I was playing drums in a group at a place called the Copycat in Fillmore. And the owner of the bar that we were working at, the Copycat, his son went to school with a guitar player from Galileo High School and he wanted to know if he could sit in with us. This is back in 1966. And so this guy sat in with the band. It was Cleve Jones Trio was the name of the band I was in. And this guy was Jerry Garcia. And he sat in one session, and he was really good, really good guitar player. And we really enjoyed what we were playing. And then we took a break, and then he sat in on a second session. So that was my association with the Grateful Dead. He just was a guy who liked to sit in with bands and play. He was a San Francisco guy, and this was a club in Fillmore Street in San Francisco back in the 60s. That was way after my first ship.
Do you remember the day you reported for duty on the USS Falgett?
Yeah, I checked in on the Falgett on December the 11th, 1961. I don't have to check my DD-214. It'll never get out of my head.
What was your impression the first time you approached the ship?
When I walked down that pier that drizzly winter night, it was warm and wet. And in those days, you had to travel in your dress blues, no matter where you went. So here I was in these hot wool Milton blues, you know, in this humid Hawaii. I looked at all those DERs lined up at Bravo Dock. I couldn't believe how small and beat up and battered they looked. They're all World War II destroyer escorts. And I couldn't believe how bad Pearl Harbor smelled in those days. Everybody was just dumping in the bay, dumping in the harbor. And my first impression wasn't all that good. Also, one thing that did bother me, being a radar tech, I was what they call an ETRSN. God, they had a lot of antennas on. I mean, TACAN antennas, radar antennas all over the place.
What was the purpose of the Falgett, like a ship like that?
In those days, a Falgett had been recommissioned from being a destroyer escort to a destroyer escort radar picket ship. We were doing barrier patrols, northern barrier patrols in the Pacific between Midway and Adak. We were an extension of the Dew Line in the Pacific. They had a similar situation going on with ships in the Atlantic. And what we did was we covered about a 1,500-mile gap between Midway and Adak, Alaska, with three stations, they called them. The owner station was Alpha Alpha, the central station was Alpha Oscar, and then Alpha Bravo was the southern station. And you would go up and you would spend 10 or 15 days on one station and move down to the next station when your relief showed up. So there was always three DERs on station between Midway and Adak. It was good. It was a good deal. One of the things we had on those ships in those days was Willie Victors would fly over. These were VP-2 planes out of ADAC, out of Midway. And we could actually see their radar on our ship. They had and this is old stuff before digital, all vacuum tube, but they would come up on station, they would be passing, and we'd give them a passing report on weather and recommended ditch heads for if they had problems, so we could do a SAR mission if we had to. And then they would ask us, how does our garden grow? And that was the code for us to check, you know, our radar and go to radar position that we had for them. And we would look and see their radar as they were flying up, looking down. It was really, really good presentation.
Who was the commanding officer when you reported aboard?
The commanding officer on the reporter board was Commander Friedman, really nice guy. We had Fairbanks Morse diesel electrics on there. So we were going to be on station, we knew anywhere from 30 to maybe 45 days, usually 30. We had a bulky boiler on there to make water. So, but we had to go on water hours. They used to allow us to grow beards when we'd go to sea. Now, we couldn't have beards in the Navy in those days, except for submarine sailors. So when we would go out, they'd grow beards, and he would ask everybody to please grow a beard, cut down on water, use some shaving, take Navy showers, of course. And Commander Friedman was funny because he requested that we do it. And then about 5 days into our first patrol, which is right after Christmas, 61, he came on and actually apologized to the crew and said he had to shave. He couldn't stand the itching, but he encouraged us all to grow our beard. And I have a trophy somewhere. They gave a contest before we came in port for best beard, most original beard, and the scroungiest beard. And I remember the leading petty officer on there, he won the best beard, good looking beard. Another ET, and he was an ET, another ET on there, Howard Walsinger, won the most original beard. And he had really dark black hair, and he had actually carved DER 324 on his face with the beard. And I had the worst looking beard in the ship, and I won the award for scroungiest beard. So ET swept at that time. We took best original and scroungiest.
How many crew members were aboard a ship like the Falgut?
Usually over 150 enlisted. And I think we're supposed to have had around 200, 201. And we had about eight officers on there. Usually around 10 or 15 chiefs, and the rest were first class and below. It was a small ship. The DERs were 306 feet long, 36 feet wide. They weren't a real big, they were SO class destroyer escorts is what they were.
Wasn't the superstructure modified as well after World War II? Didn't they extend amidship somewhere?
Yeah, what they did to accommodate more personnel, because they had to have more personnel because the increase of complement for radarmen and the increase of complement for technicians and things like that. What they did was they took weather deck on the port and starboard side, and they took about two thirds of the ship and actually extended from the hull one level down to the main deck and made living compartments and a galley and everything on the port and starboard side of the ship. So what used to be weather decks now were living compartments and they were berthing, and it was the mess decks and the chief's quarters on the starboard side were all enclosed in this modification of the ship to accommodate more personnel.
When did Sam Gravely come aboard the Falgut?
We come off what was my first patrol. Started right after Christmas in 61 and came back in January of 62. And we were told we're going to have a change of command. And it was, I think, at the end of January, 31 January of 1962 was a change of command ceremony. For the change of command, we had to all get spiffied up, put on our whites, switch on our shoes, and stand in formation outside on Bravo docks where the ship was tied up. We were tied up inboard of the nest, destroyer nest, so that all the and everything in the band, it could be right there, and the crew could be there and see the change of command. And I remember standing out there watching with everybody else, watching our shoe polish melt in the heat, they had our Captain Friedman was up on deck, and the exec was up there, and this big, tall black Navy officer, lieutenant commander, was up there. And they did the standard change of command. The officer read his orders. The relieving commander stood up to read his orders, and it was the big, tall black man. And I, nor hardly anybody else, I don't think, in the enlisted crew, knew the Lieutenant Commander Gravely was going to be our skipper. So there it was. They had to change the command, and we continued on.
Were there other crew members or officers who were black?
There were no... There was no black officers. We had Smitty, we had a third class boatswain mate. We had a cook, a second class cook. I can't remember his real name. We all called him Treetop. He was a commissaryman, second class commissaryman. There was a sonarman or torpedoman, third class, really nice guy. He was on there, and Callaway, a radarman. It was Callaway. He was in my division. The ETs, the radarman, and the weather guessers. We had two aerographers, were all in OI division. There was no OE, but we were in operations. And so we all lived together in the same compartment. That was about it. There was just a handful of black enlisted.
When was the first time you met the captain?
First time I met the captain? I probably, I could say, the first time I really met him was during our first material zone inspection. I had to stand there. I was had to present my space, which was the SPS-8 Alpha radar. It was a 3D radar, a height finder. And I presented, and that's when I first met him. And he came in and looked around and gave me an outstanding and pressed on. But it was funny, he really didn't like that radar much. It was a real pain to maintain. And it made a lot of noise at sea. If you had to do an overload reset on it, it sounded like somebody was shooting a .45 inside the cabinet, and then had these Amplodynes screaming next to it. And they are what kept the antenna stabilized. As the ship pitched and rolled, the antenna stayed perfectly level as it rotated. And those Amplodynes, high-speed DC generators, were just really noisy. It was, and it had this ugly looking Klystron that hummed and buzzed, and it glowed with the gas in it. It was a thyrotron, big thyrotron, not a Klystron, a thyrotron that was our pulse forming tube, and it glowed sort of purple. And it was about the size of a coffee pot. It was a big vacuum tube. He really did not like that radar room. So after that first time, after he'd been down there a few times when it was running, he would stand at the hatch, and if he saw us in there working, he'd say, hey, how's it going? You have any, what's going on, you know? But he didn't like to come in, and I don't blame him. It was a nasty-looking old radar.
Now, was there any crew reaction to the fact that they were getting the first black captain in the Navy?
No, I really can't remember that much of a crew reaction. They're probably surprised at first, but over a period of time, being who Captain Gravely was, how he acted, what a leader he was, I don't remember anybody having any problem with Captain Gravely at all on that ship.
Can you tell us about his leadership style or anything about him to help listeners understand what kind of man and what kind of officer he was?
His leadership style was pretty personal. He liked to make his rounds on the ship. He talked to the crew. He was pretty much interested in you. One of the things that I did personally, I was a young ETRSN. I had been married. My wife came over, and being a seaman stationed on a ship in Hawaii, living downtown, you couldn't get housing or anything. Couldn't afford a car, wasn't making much money, His wife was just like he was. His wife, Alma, was like a Navy ombudsman before they had ombudsman. She would make sure that when we were gone on patrol and barrier patrols up north, that the Navy wives were being taken care of. The enlisted wives, making sure that a chief's wife or somebody with transportation would be able to take somebody like my wife to the commissary, or if they had to go to the dispensary or do anything. She really, really looked out for the enlisted wives. And you didn't see that much in those days in the officer corps. And that's the attitude and the feeling that the guys got from him as a captain. He was our leader, and he was looking out for us. He was a pretty damn nice guy. He really treated us all well. He was a good captain. He was one of my two favorite captains in the Navy were Lieutenant Commander, then making Commander Gravely, and Captain John DeLarge on the USS Chicago. Those are my, and I had a lot of captains. My 30 years in the Navy, 30 plus, I had a lot of Navy captains, ashore and on ships. Those two were probably my two favorites. They're both. DeLarge was a great ship handler on the Chicago. He was a destroyer sailor. And Captain Gravely was a destroyer sailor. He had more of a challenge handling that DER because of how it operated than a regular destroyer. But he was good. We really liked him. I did.
He liked fishing too, didn't he?
What's that?
He liked fishing.
He loved to fish. It's funny when we were doing a nuclear test. He was on board when we were participating in the nuclear test down at Johnson at Christmas Island, and I was still a seaman and I was mess cook and I was doing my 90 days. He would come down. I was a spud coxswain. I was a potato peeler, salad maker. That's what I did down there. But he came down and he knew me from going down to the, when I was down in the radar itself. And one day he came in. We were anchored off of Johnson Island in the open sea anchorage there. And he asked me, is there any way I might be able to find some shrimp or something for him, you know? Wow, okay. Yeah, and I dug around. I found some. I gave it to him, and he wanted bait. So what he did was he had his little chair, and he would set up on the port side just outside of the light trap there where my potato peeling station was, and he would fish and catch fish. He loved to fish. And then when we were doing local ops around Hawaii or up on station, we were never moving fast. We were just maintaining the station. Sometimes we would fish just north of Midway. We'd get into big schools of tuna, and we would fish. And when we're doing local ops, at nighttime, he'd slow down if we were going in, and then we would fish and catch mahi-mahi or dolphin, Pacific dolphin. And he loved to fish and encouraged it. In fact, that became a boon. This is one thing he did for the crew. Somehow or another, he got involved at a party. He was at some function where the mayor of Honolulu was there, and you know, the Commodore was there, and the guy who the president of the Bee Tuna Factory was there, Fish and Wildlife. All these people were at this party there in Honolulu. And they were talking about it, and the Bee Tuna people were upset because they were having a hard time finding tuna, and this is back in the 60s when the boats would go down off South America. Sometimes the South American Navy, I think it was Peru, maybe Ecuador, would come out and capture our tuna boats. They'd get the ones from Hawaii and from San Diego, hold them for ransom using our destroyers that they'd bought. So they were complaining about that. And the captain told him, he says, we run into tuna all the time. And he said, what? And he says, yeah, when we're up north of Midway, you know, and we're up in this area here. And so he worked out a deal with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bee Tuna Company, where they gave us actual lures. And we went out, and when we were fishing, we could keep the fish. And when we were doing our BT drops every day, we knew what the seawater temperature was in the different layers. When we did our BT drops with the BT winch, when we catch fish, we give them a longitude, a latitude, seawater temperature. And we logged all this stuff down, and then that information was given to the wildlife people in Hawaii and the people at the Bee Tuna Company. When we came in, everybody in the crew got a tuna because we would have all these tuna that we'd caught frozen down below. Every crew member got a tuna. I would take one home. Even some of the radarmen who weren't married, they'd get a tuna. Then they'd bring it over to my place, and we could cook it up, you know. And everything was left over. The Fish and Wildlife people allowed him to sell it to Bee Tuna. They would pay for the leftover tuna, which was a few hundred tuna usually. And then he took that money and put it in a welfare and rec fund for the ship. And would finance recreational activities, beer ball games, football games at Richardson Center there in Pearl Harbor. He loved to play football, probably as much as he loved to fish. He loved to be a lineman, and he liked to run over our first-class boatswain, a big Samoan guy named Avey. He didn't play so much the softball with us, but he did play football, and he was good at it.
Any other recollections about him on the ship itself?
He pretty much stayed to his at sea. They had an at sea cabin for him up behind the quartermaster shack, right behind the pilot house. And that's where he had his meals were brought up to him and stuff. Everybody. And I remember one time when we were running north, we're getting ready to run north. We had a new OOD. I don't know if I ever told you the story of an incident, and I won't give you the answer, his name, you know, but I was, he was up there, and we'd just gone by Kauai, and we're headed north, and all of a sudden, it was right at lunchtime now, we had set up, and it was calm seas, a big rolling swell, nothing outrageous, so they didn't put down the netting on the tables, and nobody was taking precautions with her. Our metal, that we had those metal trays, you know, with the segments. So we got our noodle soup and we were getting our pork chops and the gravy and the potatoes, and everybody was settling in for lunch. And all of a sudden the ship starts heeling over to starboard as he made a hard turn, and then it's heeled back to port, making a hard turn. And it kept doing this, changing direction. And there was noodle soup flying off onto the deck and people sliding underneath tables in the mess decks and gravy and mashed potatoes on the, and it was a mess. They said, I was in the mess decks when it happened. They said Captain Gravely came boiling out of his cabin, you know, wearing his lunch to the bridge to find out what was going on. And the new ensign, who was newly qualified to OOD, was trying to avoid running over the porpoises. The porpoises were playing in our wake, and he'd see them on the starboard side. He'd try to get away from them, and then they'd show up on the port side, and he'd turn back the other direction. And the OOD was then delegated to Siberia. He sent him down to CIC so he could get squared away. And this same incident got in trouble a couple of times. He actually put him in hack one time for another incident concerning something that happened with the incident. Anyway, I won't go into that. But the crew thought it was pretty good that this guy would actually, you know, make his officers accountable when they did stuff. He rewarded people when they did good things. He looked after the crew. But if you messed up, he was fair, and he took action. He didn't mess around, because it was funny when they put the ensign in hack. He lived back aft. He was one of the junior guys, so he lived in the after officers' quarters. We called it Boys Town, which was right in the same compartment that the ETs, the radar men, lived in. And they started a pool down there. We did an OI division. How many days would the ensign be in hack? You know, very good. I remember ETR2, Bruce MacArthur, won the pool. You know, I think the ensign was hacked for 15 days. But, he was a good skipper. I mean, there's one incident. This happened during a nuclear test. We came back to the open sea anchorage. We were supposed to anchor, but he was getting orders to War College. He got his orders to War College from President Kennedy. And a commanding officer of the USS Hacienda, one of the new super orders we had in those days, I think it was AO-145, I think the hull number was anchored there. And the captain of the Hacienda, Captain Spruance, which was Admiral Spruance's son, asked him to come alongside and tie up. So he did that. He came alongside, and he didn't want to do it. The message traffic went back. He wanted to anchor and then boat over, but Captain Spruance said, tie up alongside, come aboard, we'll have breakfast, and he wanted to talk with him. And Captain Spruance was the senior officer present down there at that time. So what happened was we did tie up alongside, And Captain Gravely was correct in his assessment. We should have anchored off. So he went aboard. He went aboard the Haciampa. We're tied up. Well, the Haciampa is this huge oiler sitting there. Here's this little 36-foot wide, 306-foot long DER. And in the open sea anchorage, there was a swell. We started to roll. Well, the Haciampa wasn't. It started to stretch the lines, and we started banging against starboard side to port side, you know, of their ship. And I'm in there peeling potatoes, and all of a sudden this bulkhead splits open where I am, and some stanchions got crushed forward where the captain used to sit and fish. And the XO, Lieutenant Eller, did an emergency breakaway, had him get the lines, get rid of the lines, and we started her up and went off and anchored. So it turned out with the message traffic with the captain of the Haciampa asking him to anchor alongside, he suggested, no, I should probably anchor and boat over. And they said, no, come alongside. That Captain Sprillis probably came out the worst on that deal after he had to go in the yards and have some welding done and some patchwork done on the side of the ship. So that was an interesting time when we were down there during the nuclear tests at Johnson Island and Christmas Island.
How long did he stay aboard the ship while you were there?
He came on board at the end of January, and I believe he left. I think it was around June or July he went to War College. He left the ship. So he was on there. Usually captains were on about 18 months, and then they swapped out. But he was right at that mark, 15 to 18 months when he left. And got relieved by a lieutenant commander who had been the executive officer at Camp David, who later on ended his career as an instructor at the academy.
Did you ever see Sam Gravely after the ship?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, I saw him in San Diego once. When I was down there and I was going to... I was going through instructor training school, and he, at that time, I can't remember which ship he was on. I think he was on a Jewett, one of the ships. I visited him, and I visited my commanding officer had been captain on the Coral Sea. But I actually saw him before that, come to think of it. We had an incident on the Falgett when I was a young third. I was making third-class petty officer. And I had about 9 months to go in the Navy. And I was a duty driver one day. So he had to go from the ship. He had to go up to Test Flight 5 to see the Commodore. And they called for the duty driver, me, and I went out. And he jumped in the Jeep. And I drove him up there. Well, when he got done, he came back. And I thought I'd drive him back down to the ship. And he asked me to go out to land in Charlie, which is out by where you caught the Liberty, the boat over to Ford Island. We went out there, and I remember parking under this big banyan tree, and he talked to me about what had happened, and he said everything was okay. There was no problems. Everything was all smoothed out. It was a complete misunderstanding on my part, and there's nothing in the way of me making third class. And that was good. I thanked him very much. And then he said, have you ever considered making the Navy a career now that you've made petty officer? You're going to put on that third class crawl. And I did something that was pretty stupid. I pulled out my short timer's chain, had about 180 beads on it. I don't know if you know what a short timer's chain is, but.
What is that?
The beaded light switches that you could hang on. You could put them on a light, and it was a chain that you could turn lights and off and on with. Mm-hmm. Came in long spools, and what sailors would do is they'd get them and they would count the number of days they had. They get a long string of these things and keep them in their pocket, and every day they would clip off one of those little beads, you know. And most guys did it when they had like 90 days or 100 days maybe. You know, because so you could clip off number 100, and then when number 99 was there, now you're a two-digit twidget. You know, you're going to get out 99 days, and you just kept clipping them. Well, mine had 180 days on it, I think. I pulled it out, and he looked at it, and he said, that was probably the longest short-timer chain he'd ever seen in his Navy career, and he laughed about it. And that was it. So I didn't think anything else about it. He left the ship. I left the ship. I went to North Island and did some work there. I went to school. I went to Advanced Electronics School. Then I went to the Cruisers Chicago. And by that time, when I went on to Chicago, I was the second, but I made first class petty officer right after that. And when I was on to Chicago, we were having a change of command. Our captain was Donald Vance Cox, was getting relieved by Captain John DeLarge. And so they had this change of command in the Philippines. You know, it was 1968. I think it was March of 68. And we're all lined up. We have on our whites. It's hot. We're on the lava pier. The ship, just like it was on the Farragut, we had the bunting all on there. It was red, white, and blue hanging everywhere, and the Navy bands playing, and the whole crew, about 1,000 guys, are out there on the pier, all spiffied up. We're wearing our medals, you know, instead of ribbons, and real big ceremony on this cruiser. And all these officers are coming down. I was in the front line. There was myself, and there was a shipmate of mine, an ET1, Dallas Richard Harris, D.R. Harris, Doc. He was standing next to me. He was a black ET1. And he's standing right next to me. And he and I were pretty good buddies. We'd known each other for quite a while. And these officers were walking down the pier to go on board the Chicago. And here comes this big, tall, black Navy captain walking with some other Navy captains. And I realized, I knew who he was. I could see him. So I'm watching him, and he sort of looked over. They're looking at the troops all lined up, and he starts to veer over towards us. And I'm thinking, this guy's going to come over here and say hi to Doc Harris. He must know DR. He's the only black guy was standing out in the front line there. So he came up, and he stopped right in front of me, and he says, I know you. I know you. He says, and I said, yes, sir, you were my captain on the USS Farragut. Oh, that's right. And he saw I was an ET. He says, the longest short-timer chain I've ever seen. Well, this was just a month or so short of being a full 5 years. And he remembered that. He had a hell of a memory. So it was really fun. And he laughed and he walked off. And my buddy Harris couldn't believe it. He says, oh, my God. He says, now later I said, I'm glad he was talking to you. I thought he was going to come over and talk to me. I said, so did I. I didn't know he'd recognize who I was. I saw him a few times after that. I went back to the Bureau of Naval Personnel to be one of the ET detailers in 1978. And he was DCA. He was the Defense Communications Agency, the head of it. Their headquarters, I think, was in Fort Meade. And I went and visited him then. He'd made flag. I'd visited him then and had a nice visit. And then after he retired to Haymarket, Virginia. He was originally from Virginia. He retired to Haymarket, Virginia, and lived out there and had squabs. He raised squabs. He loved to raise these squabs. He didn't fly them, but he just raised them. And so I went out there a couple times to his house and visited him and his wife, Alma. They were just the nicest people you want to meet. They really were.
Well, Chief, thanks for sharing your recollections of Sam Gravely on behalf of the Preble Hall Museum at Preble Hall, as well as Naval History and Heritage Command, to help people understand what Sam Gravely was like.
I didn't even think about the fact or think about it very often that when he came aboard that ship, we were making Navy history. He was, anyway. Until I think you pointed that out to me, being the historian buff that you are.
A long time ago. That's when you and I were working, I think, 1993 was when you and I started working together for the Aegis Shipbuilding Program. So it had to be sometime during then. I'll tell you, I learned more about the Navy working with you than I think in any book or any other program that I work for. You're 30 years. You mentioned the Chicago, Dick, and at some point I hope we can talk about when you guys were off of Vietnam and some of the operations there 50 years ago. But, you know, as Command Master Chief of the USS Forrestal and all your experiences, I mean, when historians look at where to find information about how history really happened, you know, I've always turned to you, with a lot of incidents during the Cold War. And I really appreciate it. Thank you for educating me, but also, you know, thank you for educating folks now on Sam Gravely. I know everybody benefits from hearing from the real people out there.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.